Welcome to the Health Longevity Secret Show, and I'm your host, Dr. Robert Lufkin. For today's episode, Steve and I are excited to take you on a thought-provoking journey through the captivating world of aging, longevity, brain health, and yes, ketamine. Our conversation takes us into the incredible work of psychiatrist Dr. Jeffrey Becker, with his passion for biochemistry, pathophysiology, and the power of natural molecules. He provides intriguing insights into the potential for psychedelics and transcendence. We also delve into the role of ketamine in enhancing brain flexibility, the power of breaking patterns and shutting down that default mode network, and the journey to self-discovery. As we dig deeper into the fascinating realm of mental health, we highlight the significance of considering the brain as a metabolic organ. We discuss the potential benefits of the ketogenic diet, the importance of comprehensive physical and genetic considerations, and the exciting impact of psychedelics. So get ready for a thought-provoking conversation that takes you beyond the realm of brain health, aging, and into the world of psychedelics and beyond. And now, please enjoy this conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Becker.
And I'm very pleased today in this session to have with us Dr. Jeffrey Becker. He's known as for his focus on whole health integration, and he's been a leader in developing protocols and methodology in the world. He's a leader in developing the methodology in both functional psychiatry in consciousness medicine, and is known also for his neurobiology of ketamine and psychedelic transcendence. And I'm looking forward to getting into all of these concepts. Jeff, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure.
Great. And to get started, I would love to get a sense of what got you into this area. What inspired you to go into this area?
When I look back, I was quite naive when I was in medical school. I thought that if I went into psychiatry and I learned how to use all of these medicines that touch these receptors, that I would be somewhat of a shaman, and I'd be able to heal people by, you know, giving the right amount of medicine and give them a little bit of this and a little bit of that. At the beginning it was that kind of expansion of polypharmacy when I was in my training. I had studied in undergrad, I'd studied biology, of course, or pre-med and biology, but also had studied mysticism and had felt that transcendence and kind of spontaneous religious experience was quite healing. I found the psychedelics very healing to myself personally. And I thought, okay, well, here's this space in the middle. This is amazing. We can play. And then I found out in medical school residency, but really in private practice, really working with people, how underwhelming the results were with medications, that we could help people feel less bad, but we didn't necessarily help people feel good. We didn't help them feel well. We didn't necessarily make them well with the medication. We could resolve acute extreme suffering, I think, a lot of times. Mm-hmm. But what we didn't know how to do was help people expand and become who they are with the kind of medical toolbox. Mm-hmm. I think that the psychological toolbox, the therapy toolbox, in some sense, you know, some of the spiritual concepts I'd learned in undergrad, I think there are a lot of tools out there, but the medical toolbox seemed to be, again, underwhelming. And that's when I really dived into the functional world. I loved biochemistry. I loved pathophysiology and the combination of the two. For some reason, I've always had an ability to kind of see, you know, as above, so below, mm-hmm. Kind of thinking, like the fractal nature of microscopic patterning all the way to macroscopic patterning has always been just something kind of intuitive to me. And so I just a lot of basic principles regarding fundamental molecules in health really got plugged in medical school. And I had the benefit of having that understanding all the way through my training, so that, you know, when I learned about the breakdown product of dopamine being peroxide, which turns very commonly into hydroxyl in the presence of iron, then the next step is, well, maybe it would be good if we didn't break down dopamine as much with MAO, MAOB to be specific. And, you know, that caused me to look that up. And this was, we barely had the internet was running, but it wasn't full blown. But then I found the papers on selegiline and all of the kind of animal data showing improved lifespan and a kind of anti-aging effect from selegiline. And so I dive deeper into that. Like, what are the mechanisms? Well, it turns out it's not just that. It's also that it seems to increase catalase levels, you know, and endogenous and antioxidant. And so these are it was so fun. It was so much fun. And then it was a lot of fun to start to put these principles into play in medical care, in psychiatry, because in some ways, again, another aspect of this that I think was interesting was that the brain is really in very much, I mean, the metaphor of it being a black box, it still is, really. I mean, we really have very little way of probing the brain in terms of its metabolic state, especially in patient care, maybe university labs and things like that. But we have to use extrapolation, we have to use intuition, and we have to use patterning. Now we can use genetics, actually, which are just, you know, the pricing of genetics has come down to where it's just astounding what you can get for $99 now. It allowed me to play with natural molecules. I always felt like if you really can be pretty sure you're not going to hurt somebody and you think you might be able to help, and you're actively engaged and you are engaged in clinical correlation, you've identified signs and symptoms and a reasonable guess at pathophysiology, and there's literature to support it, do something about it. And then check up with the patients, see if they get better. And over time, you really learn what works and what doesn't.
That's great. And I can really resonate with what you said really at the beginning, which is how there's a leap between just trying to get people okay versus really feeling well. Because my experience is that most people, if we break the whole range of experience, most people are typically living in the bottom half. And their goal each day is, I want to make sure nothing bad happens today. Let's hope everything is okay at the end of the day. So it fits with exactly what you're saying. What would you say is your perspective on aging and longevity?
It's a complex question, because you've got a lot of different layers to what that means. If you look at, you know, what Eric Erickson was getting at in the eight stages of man, you know, non-inclusive language, but eight stages of the human being. A lot of what that middle stage of life is about is basically solving a specific problem, kind of maintaining generativity, creativity versus despair. Being able to stay engaged and repeatedly reinvent oneself and reinvent the sources of meaning. When we find that things have changed or we've graduated, we've actually developed past where that particular form of meaning was sustainable, was nourishing. Now it might, and when you do this properly, you move up a layer, that's still there, but you want more, right? You're looking for more. So I think this is the kind of spiritual aspect of development. And I think this is why it's been so exciting to see the acceptance of psychedelics in terms of kind of care of the soul and staying kind of open-hearted. I think that it's very easy to get smaller as we get older, more fearful, more rigid, more constrained, less comfortable with being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, these things can help to kind of push those boundaries open and hopefully open ourselves up but also on the molecular side.
Yeah.
I mean, if you are getting older and your deep sleep is harder and harder to get as we get older, as the cholinergic tone in our brain goes downhill, and you don't get that growth hormone pulse and that kind of nice, clean hypothalamic pituitary axis kind of symphony tuning up that is occurring during deep sleep in the first phase of sleep at night, it's no wonder we don't feel so as well in the morning, or we don't recover. So that's maybe at the, you know, at the lowest level. So addressing, again, I think that we have to think in terms of body, mind, and soul or spirit, and really be thinking about all these things if we're talking about what is anti-aging. Take care of the molecular. It's really the foundation. If you don't do that, it's kind of, it's a bit silly in a sense to think that just expanding the mind is going to fix everything. If the metabolism and the tissue and the brain, which burns 20 to 25% of our calories every single day in a very small space.
Yeah. So
if that tissue can't support, you know, an expanded consciousness, then we're not doing our patients, a proper in that sense.
Right. And what I appreciate in what you just said is you're really talking about the quality of aging, the quality of life in the process of aging, and which ties into the next question, Jeff, which is, how does the mind and mental health conditions impact aging and longevity?
Well, we see this in so many ways. It's almost, you know, you might ask, how does it not? We constrictive beliefs can constrict behavior and can constrict opportunity or recognition of opportunity. And so, you know, that kind of inquisitiveness that we see in the young, where they explore their environment, right? And they discover new things, and those new things lead to, excitement and a kind of leaning into life and all of that. You know, if there's a use it or lose it kind of quality, both to the body and to the neurons and the brain and the mind, that process, I think, is very important. And I have been deeply fascinated by a particular set of a particular aspect of control over consciousness, actually, which is the GABAergic inner neuron net that actually both constricts and stereotypes the way that we think, and comes on substantially in the tween years, and kind of is mostly finished with its pruning and kind of conducting of the kind of ego, the everyday perception of ourselves internally, by the time we're about 30.
And so
we know this
that's a neurotransmitter system you're referring to?
Yeah, called the GABAergic inner neuron net. And it's not a tract like everybody else, about the way that we think of the catecholamines. It's not like the dopamine tract that starts one place and projects out and does certain things. It's kind of like almost a plastic matrix kind of controlling our thinking. And it's very specific in this sense. There's a cell called the chandelier cell that actually has a chokehold on pyramidal cell activity. It's got its axon, which is inhibitory, around the axon of a pyramidal cell. It is literally the arbiter of whether a pyramidal cell can fire or not. And these are the cells that ketamine preferentially gets onto in low doses and inhibits. So ketamine inhibits that inhibitor. And what you see is this blooming of interactions across neurons. These neurons are allowed to share information with each other where normally they would be shut down. It would be, you know, that chandelier cell says, nope, you know, you don't share information with that neuron. You share information with this set of neurons. You know, the default mode network and executive network and salience networks. We know that there is a stereotyping of interaction. And so breaking that up, kind of dissembling that, I think can be very helpful for people to kind of crack out of, the kind of straitjacket of their own conception of who they are. It can lead to kind of deep creativity. that leads to, you know, entire new chapters. I've watched it. I've done 20 years of using ketamine in clinical practice in mental health applications, and it's just been astounding to see what it can do for people.
So are you suggesting that the use of low doses of ketamine creates greater integration in the brain? Would you characterize it that way?
That's almost perfectly said. And this isn't, you know, really up for debate. We see this in functional imaging. We see that when a depressed subject, or even a just subject that's not depressed, is under kind of sub-anesthetic ketamine doses, the kind of 0.5 milligram per kilogram dosing that we use so much in treating mental health disorders, PTSD, treatment-resistant depression, what we see in the brain is that the nodes that normally are interacting with each other with stereotyped kind of relationships, like the default mode network is an example, those relationships fall away, that those areas are talking less to each other. But we also see, weirdly, and really I think it explains a lot, we see the areas that are anti-correlated to those nodes now speaking with those nodes. It's as if every area of the brain is all of a sudden allowed to talk with other areas of the brain more easily, that the rule set of like, you and you get to share information, and then we make a decision based on that. All of a sudden there's all kinds of information coming in that leads to, you know, a sense of something. And if you work with people with ketamine, what's very interesting is how deeply symbolic and meaningful the experience is, that they'll use these words of like, there's this wholeness to it. There's this integration. It's so large. It's so meaningful. It's so beautiful. And a lot of what I think they're getting at is that there's a wholeness to what they're experiencing, some aspect of who they are. It's pulling from memory, from intellect and the conceptual, from, you know, the emotional, and even a lot of times, even with eyes closed, from the kind of visual cortex. I think we store a lot of information in memory and pictures as well. The evocative nature of that all kind of comes together, and people feel like they've rediscovered themselves. Maybe it's the deep self, I think, in a sense.
That's amazing.
It's amazing to watch. It's so fun.
I can imagine. Yes. Would you also say that it's increasing like the flexibility of the brain, like it's taking the brain out of its rut? Because a lot of emotional disability is really, part of it is that the brain is just kind of stuck in a pattern. Would you say that it's kind of freeing the brain from that stuckness?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We know that, you know, complex systems tend to fall into patterning, and that patterning ends up in some ways creating its own grooves that repeat that patterning more easily over time, right? That's we just see this all over the place. So finding a way to crack through that actually is really, it's very heartening to the patients when they rediscover aspects of themselves or discover aspects that they didn't even know were there. There's this kind of recruitment of old forms of joy and meaning that feels particularly holistic for patients. I mean, I'll give you just a really easy, quick example is, a young woman kind of in her 30s who feeling that estrangement in her 30s that a lot of people feel like, is this it? You know, I used to feel like life, there was adventure, there was something I was looking towards or I was going towards, and then now it just feels like each day is a day and it ends, and then it's the next day is the same. And she found, you know, she remembered just very simple, but it just is such a big thing, how much she loved the violin. She used to be an incredible violin player. And one day in her late 20s, she put the violin in the closet and forgot about it. Isn't that weird? It's very weird, actually. We become so so driven towards goals or towards kind of proxy markers for goals or for where we want to get or who we want to be, that we forget about what we are actually, that she's a beautiful violinist and that that's something that gave her joy and meaning and also helped her escape from, you know, music is so transcendent for people. It helps us, I think it helps elevate as well. So I've seen so many amazing transformations like that, that I don't even know where to start. I mean, I could give you another one if I can sure. I give you another quick story just to explain? Okay. This was an amazing story. I was working with a woman. She was about 50, and she had a deep, deep kind of almost a character traits, like a sorrow, just a deep sorrow. And I have a lot, I can go there really too as well. I grew up with a lot of kind of achy pain that I really, when I studied mysticism, really realized that a lot of it was agape, just kind of maybe C.S. Lewis's concept that agape is pain per se, that if you really are in touch with it, it's hard to be here. It's hard to just see the suffering. And I, you know, we connected on that. But what's interesting about her is that she ran away from this in particular, as, you know, it was very scary how intense it was, how much that pain was so intense. And she would describe to me that she ended up in graphic arts, and which was, you know, interesting to go into the visual in the artistic world. But she found that repeatedly she would be at people's beds and she would be the one that would be there when they would die. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe the family's gone down to dinner and, you know, she decides to stay. And that's the moment the person in the hospital bed decides, I'm out of here, you know, and she's holding the hand. I took note of this. And anyway, we moved into her using ketamine, and it was almost like a triptych for her. The first time she came out, she was just really gloriously just expressing how she felt like she'd been held by God, like she'd finally really returned to a state. So it's kind of resolution of estrangement, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why this question of like, why did you put me here? Why did you put me here to be in so much pain for a whole lifetime, right? I mean, what is this about, right? The second session, she actually came, she was crying, and it was, you know, I was kind of quiet, but, you know, hoping to understand what was going on. And she really expressed that she really realized that she had not known what she was. Mm. And I had a hint of what was going on here. But the third time she comes out and she says, I know what I need to do. I mean, it's just, like, could you ask for any more of like these things fall so nicely into these kind of spiritual
journey.
Yes. It's just amazing. And she said, I should have been a nurse. Mm. And then, you know, mind you, she's 50. She didn't do any hard science in her undergrad. She went back to undergrad to City College and she took core science. She got a scholarship to a nursing program. She ended up going into hospice and into nursing leadership. And her life is, you know, she still feels the pain, but now she's using it. She's, mm. you know, this is her gift, right?
Yes.
And I'm so excited that we're in a new era where we can talk about this in medicine, that this is, these are very, very real, you know, aspects of healing that if we don't address as doctors, you know, we're going to get left behind.
Mm. Yeah. You know, some of the research shows that what makes a difference in these journeys or these experiences is whether the person going through it has a spiritual experience. Is that what you find also?
Definitely. In fact, there's even specific research. I wish there were more, but there are good studies, two of them that I can think of offhand that have shown that the response to the drug is correlated to basically the spiritual quality of the experience, you know, the magnitude and the quality of the experience. And that's why the people that really know what they're doing in the field, we dose to effect, properly delivered for a patient. There's no fixed dose. You start with basic principles, but you do need to move the dose up until a patient kind of experiences that expanded state, I think, for them to have receive the full potential healing that ketamine can offer, for sure.
Right. So you use the term consciousness medicine, Jeff. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what you're referring to with that term?
Well, this is a messy field. There are a bunch of words out there for the psychedelics and for ketamine. And then there's this debate, is ketamine a psychedelic, and are psychedelics, fundamentally different? Well, they're absolutely fundamentally different in mechanism of action, but there's a convergence of effect. And what I'm getting at with this in terms of consciousness medicine is that consciousness per se, its size, its scope, its quality, the stereotypies that are involved, is a potential target for treatment. And that understanding what it is and having, working paradigms and knowing how to apply, the psychedelics, ketamine, other molecules that actually have consciousness expanding effects for tonic daily use, is a very important aspect, I think, of what psychiatrists should be thinking about. I think this is, and they are, and that's again why it's been such a wonderful decade here. I think the reemergence of this interest. But again, I will always say, and this is one of the things, don't forget, if you're a doctor, to do your labs, and remember that if somebody has a low B12 level, or they have low glutathione levels, or their magnesium is in the lowest fifth percentile because they're a drinker, they're not going to feel well if you have a psychedelic experience. They will often feel quite wrecked afterward, actually. And mm-hmm. This happens out there a lot, and doctors and therapists and underground practitioners kind of root around saying, what is this? And I will say, it's something that you can probably figure out. You need to do your labs and your genetics.
Can you give us a little bit of your thought process as you do a workup on one of these complex cases?
I think at the base level, if you think of kind of brain, if it's mental health or brain and body, they're in typical psychiatry. Often, actually, it's not atypical in psychiatry that there are zero labs drawn. A lot of times labs are thought of as the internist's job, or the internist has done enough labs and the psychiatrist looks at them and says, okay, there's nothing going on, at a metabolic level. Internist has signed off. Now it's time for me to apply my behavioral patterning, signs and symptoms, right? And define the disease, define the disorder, and then offer a treatment. I think that this is a mistake in psychiatry, because my psychiatry should think of it as tertiary care, and should remember that the internists often did not get very much training in terms of the brain as an actual organ, as right. a metabolic organ, like how it works. And remembering the biochemistry of the brain. I mean, again, I would just point out that it burns 20 to 25% of the calories in a given day. That's a big deal. It's similar to the heart in that sense, that its metabolic requirements are both quite demanding and also create a substantial burden of oxidative molecules, reactive oxygen species, and basically just garbage. That needs to be processed properly. And if people don't have the basic molecules they need to do that, their brain is not going to function very well as an organ. So I do a deep, my functional workup, it starts with a lab review, and I ask patients to get every single lab they can get their hands on. I tell them, if you can find childhood labs, I want to see them. I ask them to put them in temporal order, save them as one single document so that I can spin through, and it works as a, it's a timeline. And now I have a bit, and a lot of people have a lot of labs. And you know, if you do this a lot as a doctor, you can spin through them pretty quickly. And what you're seeing is a movie play out. You're not seeing a single snapshot in time. Then I also have their questionnaire, which is fairly granular. My questionnaire, I think, is probably a lot more specific and granular than the average psychiatric intake, partly because I'm really looking for signs and symptoms of specific nutrient deficiencies, B12, zinc, magnesium, copper zinc, ratio, high copper zinc ratio. I look a lot at syndromes like polycystic ovarian syndrome, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth that can really, really, these kinds of things that can affect the brain very specifically. Yes, technically it's a GI syndrome, but it, you know, SIBO just ravages the brain. So does polycystic ovarian syndrome. It gets very commonly misdiagnosed as depression, atypical depression, and ADD, when in reality, it's really, in some ways, it's an insulin insensitivity, kind of a type 2 diabetes light. So gathering signs and symptoms, gathering labs, and then also doing genetics. And truth be told, I just use the 23andMe panel. It's $99. You get 650,000 SNPs for $99. And I've had my own reader programmed. I've got the SNPs that I'm interested in. I follow about 300 of them, but there are a lot in there that are really worth. You don't have to follow 300. I mean, I think if you follow, even if you just only follow like 15 to 20 on a given patient, you can really discern a lot about what might be going on with them. Some of these SNPs are so specific. I mean, one of the like methionine synthase reductase SNP, there's a version of it, very, very common, in Caucasian Americans. And if you have two copies of it, you're four times more likely to have a child with cleft palate or spina bifida. And what we're getting at here is really, this is a very clear clinical sign that this enzyme doesn't work that well in the process of reducing cobalamine, the cobalt on B12, after it becomes oxidized. It becomes oxidized after about 1,000 to 2,000 reactions, bringing homocysteine back to methionine. And some people have a version of that, that it doesn't bring the cobalt back into the proper valence. And that's a person that really probably can benefit from high dose methylcobalamin to support their metabolism, but you won't find it without the genetics. And you can find it for $99. I mean, it's just astounding.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the ketogenic revolution in mental health? You know, some are saying that it can reverse some mental health conditions. Chris Palmer has a new book out on this.
Yes, absolutely. There are two really easy aspects of leverage to point to as to why it could be so helpful. One is simply that, you know, if you think about, I don't know if you've ever driven a diesel car, but you know, once you drive a diesel car, you don't go back to gasoline. They're so stable. You know, they just go forever. And they get a lot of mileage out of a gallon of diesel compared to gas. Gas is like, it's just on off. Yes, it helps you jump off the line, but you're just having to go to the gas station all the time, right? It's just fast fuel. So I kind of think of it similarly in that way, and that so many of us get used to with the 3-meal-a-day kind of model. You know, we get used to that fast fuel, then it's off. And that just creates, well, it runs the insulin system ragged, but the brain doesn't like that either. It doesn't like the ups and the downs. And so, you know, training the body to live on ketones and using fatty acids, and even, you know, I actually believe I'm less specific about having patients do keto than I am that they do intermittent fasting. Because I believe that if you intermittent fast properly, what you end up doing is really turning up the architecture that produces this type of fuel for the brain anyway. It can take a couple weeks for the brain to kind of, and the brain and the body to kind of get used to it. And then you find people will say, yeah, it was really hard in the beginning, and now I don't even notice it. I don't feel that feeling of like I'm hungry, and their energy is a lot more stable. That said, some people, that's not the proper path, and actually more of a ketogenic diet and the C8 and C10 fats and things like that, MCT oils and stuff like that can be nicely supportive. But you know, a perfect example of what I was just getting at, polycystic ovarian syndrome, 1 in 8 women really looks at some core level like it has a lot to do with insulin resistance. And you'll see a lot of carbohydrate craving in these individuals. And if you can get them to change their diet and move over and get on to a longer slow burn fuel, they just do so much better. Sometimes, again, though, to remind again, you know, check your chromium levels, because a lot of them are low in chromium, and they don't, that's glucose tolerance factor. That's the metal in the middle of glucose tolerance factor. If you don't have your chromium, trivalent chromium, you're going to have insulin issues, and chromium's gone down in our diets by about 30% over since 1950. Mm. So anyway, I'm again saying don't ever forget the labs and all that, but I think it can be very helpful that way. And of course, for aging, you know, it's not good for us to blow our insulin system out, and if we're not careful, you know, it happens. Sugar is pretty toxic.
Right. So you mentioned intermittent fasting. What is the schedule that you recommend the most?
It depends on the person. Some people never like breakfast. It's just not natural for them. I'm one of those folks. If I eat breakfast, I'm tired by noon, and I eat more, and I don't feel as well. It's weird. I don't know why. I've thought that I could figure out what's going on, what kind of patterning or something. And I just kind of gave up a long time ago and just said, whatever a person's natural patterning is, so let's work with it. Some people really, they breakfast is very important, in which case, you know, you try to eat all of your food within an 8-hour period, essentially, is what it means. So I don't care what 8 hours. It's not ideal to go to bed on a full stomach, of course. So, you know, there's other principles to kind of include in that, but I don't feel, you know, ideologic about it has to be breakfast, or it has to be, you know, the other way around. Mm-hmm. There has been some data that says that it's not good to not eat in the morning. And then there's some data that says that it's okay. And sometimes it says you shouldn't have coffee and you should. I just say, do what feels right at a certain level, but give your bowel some rest from feeding all that bacteria in your small bowel. You know, it's the best way to get rid of SIBO. You know, I think it may be the only way, honestly.
So
small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, excuse me.
Psychedelics have been referred to as neuroplastic. Can you elaborate on that?
So what they mean by neuroplastic is that there's this kind of window of potential for learning and for kind of new connectivity, increases in dendritic densities, and it's not a surprise that if you know how they work. I was talking about ketamine before, that ketamine inhibits the inhibitor. It inhibits the chandelier cell primarily at the kind of low doses that we use. Partly because those cells are slightly excited, and that means the magnesium isn't in the NMDA receptor, and the ketamine can get on them preferentially, turn them off. And then all the cells are allowed to talk to each other, the pyramidal cells. Psychedelics work differently. They attach to the cell body and the proximal dendrite coming in. And when that 5-HT2A serotonin receptor is activated, what it does is it increases the chances that any given cell is going to fire based on a given amount of stimulus. So it's kind of like a global stimulant in a sense for pyramidal cells, but not in the way that we normally think of stimulants being norepinephrine driven and maybe some dopamine. Neither of those catecholamines. It just increases the ability of that neuron to fire. Remember that inhibitory neuron, the chandelier cell I was talking about, it's still trying to stop that firing maybe, but it gets overwhelmed And now there's new connectivity, right? Cells have been able to overwhelm the inhibitory tone, right? And you're, the dose matters, obviously. You take a lot and you get a lot of increased catalyst effect in terms of firing, and a little bit and maybe a little bit. I think this is where the microdosing model comes in, and has been quite interesting to watch that grow. The idea of using a very small amount every 2 or 3 days just to kind of help keep an expansive state. And also why a whole lot in some people where control over thought and all that may be actually pretty important, and kind of breaking that down isn't always a good thing for some people. I mean, you can have post psychedelic psychosis, of course, in some individuals. So these are all, solid considerations about whether somebody is a proper candidate and dosing and what drug and all of that and support, before and after.
Yeah. But based on the mechanisms that you're discussing, it seems to me that what you're suggesting is these are substances that not only can be beneficial to people with mental illness problems, depression, anxiety, but also for the average person, they could increase their brain health.
Yes, I would say that, we always have to be careful as doctors when we start applying something to somebody that doesn't have a disease or a disorder exactly. But, aging and dying and memory loss is all, these are, is that a disease? FDA doesn't feel that aging is a disease, but I mean, in some ways, I mean, it's a process of the question of whether it needs to occur at least at the rate that it does. I think it's a very legitimate one. And in that kind of use it or lose it model, in increasing connectivity and increasing creativity and, maybe dusting off sources of meaning and kind of integrated sense of self. These are all aspects of consciousness that I think are, it's not hard to understand why that might improve both health span and lifespan even. Mm-hmm. I think we tend to make better choices when we feel better, and we tend to take better care of ourselves. And there's an orientation towards the world that's often more healthy. The food that we choose to put in our body tends to improve. And, it all kind of adds up.
Yeah. Well, this is such a fascinating subject, and a mushrooming subject.
Yes.
As well. No pun intended there. Can you briefly describe the differences between the most common psychedelics in use right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of fun. I think that the most common thing for any given person, I mean, if you just queried 100 people in a room, I think mushrooms are probably the most commonly experienced. And, they've been around a long, long time, of course. Gordon Wasson discovered that those were not phallic, stones, down in Mexico, but mushroom god stones and all of that. And we discovered this, the psilocybin class, and that psilocybin is a prodrug, and it turns into psilocin. It's got a phosphate on it that's cleaved off by a phosphatase, and that psilocin is basically called 4-hydroxy-DMT. That DMT part is kind of important. 4-hydroxy means that DMT has got a little substitution on there. It lasts about, anywhere from 4.5 to 5 hours to maybe 8, depending on the dose. And it tends to have a quality that's very, generally, it's very spiritual. It's less intellectual. It's less kind of people in the field will say it's less clear headspace. But also, I think a lot of people feel it can be the deepest of the spiritual experience. Depending on the person, it can be quite punishing as well. Sometimes it can be, the Jungian concept of the tree that has its leaves in heaven has its roots in hell, I think is very pertinent in this. Mm-hmm. When one moves into the psychedelic arena, this is a very, very, very real considerations. I mean, you do it enough and it's very, you will have a dark experience at some point. Being prepared for that and understanding it, I think, is important. LSD, of course, you know, discovered from the Aragut fungus by Albert Hofmann, the 25th compound that they had isolated from that Claviceps purpurea. And there are LSD analogs or close molecules in morning glory and rosewood and things like that. But LSD, very, very potent and kind of a cleaner kind of experience, a little bit more intellectual. I think that is often where people turn when they're looking at microdosing and they want to be able to kind of work and kind of grind out, you know, more maybe tedious stuff, you know, whereas mushrooms, you might microdose mushrooms and be like, wow, I'd really rather be out, like, you know, walking through those oak trees than, you know, getting the slide deck done, kind of thing. So lasts a long time, a lot longer than I've often enjoyed. But it's, you know, is what it is. These things have their own pharmacokinetics. Mm-hmm. On that 5-HT2A receptor. They all attach to that receptor, at least partially. And then they have these other flavors by probably how they bind to the receptor, we're finding out. And then also probably other receptor binding profiles that kind of create flavor. And then there's mescaline, of course, from the peyote cactus. And that's actually a phenylethylamine. And the LSD is a lysergamide. It's a different scaffold. And then we have phenylethylamine, looks not that far off from norepinephrine and dopamine, really. Whereas the psilocybin, and it looks more like serotonin. Mm-hmm. But mescaline, very non-potent. You know, it's more like 300 milligrams. But that was the original, a lot in many ways, one of the most important molecules in our history, with Aldous Huxley having, you know, his two really major and important experiences with mescaline leading to Doors of Perception and Heaven and Hell, as these kind of short, very, very powerful and very, very deeply felt and meaningful kind of extended essays about what the experience is like. If anybody has not read those are very pertinent. Mm-hmm. Still today. And then finally, you know, we have the rise of ayahuasca, which is really kind of amazing. And DMT, of course, which, mm-hmm, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, it's so simple that our body breaks it down quickly if you take it orally. So ayahuasca uses DMT from one plant and an MAO inhibitor from another in order to decrease the ability to break down the DMT, so the DMT gets into the body. It's broken down by an enzyme called monoamine oxidase. If you take a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, then that means that the DMT can get into our bloodstream and kind of come on slowly and powerfully and kind of stay up for a while, and then slowly it gets broken down. And so there's kind of a rise and a fall that's much over a much longer arc, you know, 8 hours, even 10 hours, depending. Yeah. Whereas DMT that's inhaled is like a rocket ship straight into the space, because it goes right into the brain and very, very rapid onset, and can be very quite scary for people, but also can be quite profound.
Yeah. This is a fascinating subject with a lot of implications. Jeffrey, I'm so pleased that we had the opportunity to have this conversation. If people wanted to reach you or learn more about what you are doing, how can they do that? And would you have something that people like an ebook or a pamphlet on some of this that people can reach out to you for?
Yes, you know, we talked about this before, and I definitely have a few things that I think I'll pull together and and offer here at the end of this. For me, I do have my own personal website that's associated with my practice as a doctor. I'm also the science director of an early startup pharma company that is developing ketamine, a subcutaneous form of ketamine with a patch pump, a wearable, simple to use patch pump, take off a sticker, put it on for pain management, actually, and post-operative pain as our flagship. But that will be, you know, that's our starting point. And then we will branch into mental health. And we're looking at other indications as well. we need an effective, you know, convenient way of delivering ketamine in a parenteral fashion to get this back into the psychiatrist's office. I have lots and lots of anesthesiologist friends who have anesthesia clinics, and I'm on the board of ASKP, American Society of Ketamine Providers. I very much believe in their good work, but I do also feel that it's a shame, and it's really not acceptable that the psychiatrists have not had access to this powerful medication in a way that works. We have to deliver this in this subcutaneous fashion so that we can get people into the space properly and dose attune. So that's been my mission for the last 5 years. And that's Bexson Biomedical, BEXSON. You can follow us there.
Great. Well, again, Jeff, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And good luck in what you're doing with that company.
Thank you both. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. And I really appreciate what you are both doing. It's I feel privileged to be invited.
Thank you.
If you are enjoying this program, please hit that subscribe button, or even better, leave a review. Your support makes it possible for us to create the quality programming that we're continually striving for. Also, let us know if there is a certain topic that you would like to see covered or a particular guest that you would like to hear from.
This is for general information and educational purposes only, and it's not intended to constitute or substitute for medical advice or counseling. The practice of medicine or the provision of healthcare, or diagnosis or treatment, or the creation of a physician-patient or clinical relationship. The use of this information is at their own user's risk. If you find this to be on the value, please hit that like button to subscribe to support the work that we do on this channel. And we take your suggestions and advice very seriously, so please let us know what you'd like to see on this channel. Thanks for watching, and we hope to see you next time.